From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio, focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you being with us as we move on through the month of August, and we're pleased to welcome in Lincoln Snyder, the superintendent of our great Catholic schools throughout these 20 counties of the Diocese of Sacramento. Lincoln, good day to you.
Yeah, good morning. How do you do?
Doing very, very well, or I guess as good as the circumstances permit. You're right in the thick of it. So much happening here. So many questions that people have. Where do we start talking about our Catholic schools and how they're going to open, when they're going to open, et cetera?
Well, yeah, there's that old backhanded blessing of may you live in interesting times.
Yes.
Interesting times indeed. Yeah, the good news is four of our schools are in the midst of returning and holding their regular first days of instruction.
So, in person.
In person. We've got a very big and geographically diverse diocese, and state policy does acknowledge that, you know, COVID is at different levels in different places. And so four of our schools, St. Joseph in Reading, Sacred Heart in Red Bluff, Holy Trinity in El Dorado Hills, and then Mount St. Mary Academy in Grass Valley, are returning to school for regular instruction, of course, with significant safeguards in place. But they're back in class, and school is moving forward. So that's we've been working closely with them as they start up, and then for the rest of the team, the governor has asked us to apply for waivers to be able to come back, which puts us into conversation with county health. So we've been doing that.
So we've had initially the plan was to come back all in person, going back to Friday the 13th of March when the decision was made to close the schools. It wasn't a statewide decision. It really was here was just a decision in with prudence. And with the public schools, the same thing. It kind of varied by school district to school district, but happened for most on Friday the 13th. And by the 16th, our Catholic schools were back in session virtually, which really beat everybody else and shocked everybody. And that's the way it finished out. You know, everybody thought it was going to be a week or two or three maybe, and went all the way through May and June. But then you were planning, starting in the middle of August, to go back in person. And really in the last month or so, the state decided that just we weren't going to allow that, they weren't going to allow that to happen, and it was going to be on a county by county basis.
Yeah, exactly. And levels do vary county by county. You know, so there's been some policy challenges at the state level, as I'm sure as many of the listeners have noted. The state has reconsidered the validity of some of its own testing data. Mm-hmm. And so they're having to go back and revise the data, which is problematic, of course, because they created a policy that said if infections are above a certain level, and it's in the case of California, it's 100 infections per 100,000 people, the county for more than 3 days, the county goes on a monitoring list. And mm-hmm. if the county's on a monitoring list, school can't resume until it comes off the monitoring list, or the schools are given a waiver. So the challenge is that, you know, as I've been working with county health officials, you know, we've got a very robust protocol that addresses all of the concerns that the state asked us to address in the waiver process. But they're, of course, anxious to not give us bad advice because there's uncertainty as to what the infection levels actually are in some areas. So, yeah, it's a real challenge for us because, like I said, the state realized it doesn't even have good data, has to revise it, and, you know, we know that asks a lot of our parents and communities to say, okay, I know we said we're working toward this goal, but we need to know where we're at first before we can figure out where we go next, and so, you know, please hang tight.
What happens if a school is back in person and then that county goes over the threshold?
So the school doesn't automatically close. Once a county reopens and the schools go back into session, then it's a matter of us monitoring the school itself. And mm-hmm. so essentially if a student or teacher within a given class would take ill, and we're organizing our classes into cohorts, so the teacher and the students will only be around each other for that class during the school day. If one of them were to take ill, the class would likely go home for a two-week quarantine, and we'd go straight into distance mode for that class. And if more than 5% of our students at the school took ill, the county could ask us to move the whole school to distance mode again for 2 weeks while the families quarantine and wait it out. And so that's what would happen going forward, regardless of where the county itself is at. So once we're in session, then we're just monitoring the school.
So part of it is you're making the call, and part of it the county may step in.
Yes, exactly. I mean, our policy has always been to work very closely with county health officers. You know, as we know, with the medical science is not an exact science, and it's very much the duty of the health officer to consider all sources and review all studies and then talk to other neighboring health officers, and they are doing their best to set policy based on, you know, what they understand to be the case. And so we're very deferential to their opinions, you know, that they're trying to balance a lot of interests. So it's been a good conversation. The good news is they are talking to each other, and mm-hmm. they have communicated that I think there's a consensus that, well, first of all, you know, younger kids are not efficient transmitters. And so just based on data from countries that have gone back, it does appear to be the infection rates are not going up as these countries have returned to school, and particularly in the younger grades, because, you know, children do seem to have not perfect protection. You know, of course, you know, there's always a risk for our children. We're very mindful, but the younger child is, the less risk there is, certainly at the state level. You know, no children 12 or under have died of COVID in the state of California. And so it doesn't mean that we don't take it extremely seriously and do everything we can to prevent COVID. So the health officers are really trying to take all of this data into account and then give us guidance on what the most reasonable and prudent policy is for us to get kids back into school, knowing that there's a strong public health interest in them being back in class for all the advantages that brings, emotional, social, economic. You know, we've got a lot of kids that are not supervised when they're at home, or parents who can't work if the kids are at home, with all of the consequences of that. So, they've been working very hard to balance all of those interests and come up with guidance for us. And again, that's just meant that I've been in very close contact with 11 different counties to get a sense of where things are at for their region and set the policy for our schools accordingly.
And then you have parents like me who are totally incompetent in helping their children with distance learning.
Well, you know, it was a stressful spring for a lot of folks. I mean, yeah. I think even, you know, my wife and I laugh. We both got masters in education, and it's a tough to teach your own kid.
Yeah, it's hard.
You know? We have that, you know, we're concerned about a lot of things. We're concerned about the achievement gap. We're concerned about students, you know, having different levels of success. On top of that, though, if you look at just families of greater socioeconomic need, you know, we feel that those children are at a significant disadvantage.
Yeah.
And part of the reason that infection rates don't go up in countries that have returned to school is because very often when children are unsupervised during the day or at home, as I've observed in my own community, it's not like they've been at home quarantining. They've been out and about in the community with their friends. And so, you know, because we have such robust policies for our schools, you know, we feel that the school environment is going to be as safe an environment as any for our students outside of a strict quarantine within the home.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, as divided as our country is on so many things, it seems almost universally accepted among all people that being in person, obviously, given safeguards, et cetera, but in-person learning is just night and day better than virtual learning.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very proud of the job that our teams have done with virtual learning, and if we're called on to do it, we'll do it. And we felt like we kept the kids on track academically. But there's all the other benefits. And
right.
So we've been talking about faith, community, and growth being our priorities as Catholic schools. And, you know, the faith piece and the community piece definitely come when people are together, and we understand that together means something different now than it did in January, because, you know, we have to. So, for example, for schools, we're offering class masses at all of our schools as our students are coming back, of course, following the protocols we've got in place for our churches, which, in most of our parishes and most of our community, our counties rather, can still do outdoor mass. You know, Bishop mm-hmm. Soto offered a dispensation and approved the policy for outdoor masses. And so, you know, we know that when people are wearing masks and 6 feet distance and outdoors and in groups of less than 100, that's a way for us for them to come to the table and receive the sacraments, but in a way that's also offers them a high degree of protection and safety mm-hmm. From COVID. And so, you know, we feel very strongly that it's important to get our kids back into communion and, you know, together with their families. And so I know all of our schools are working very hard to start the school year with bringing our kids, like I said, back to church, but doing it in a way that we know that we can ensure their safety.
Yeah, it, with masses, and we talked to Bishop last week, and he said, you know, in many cases, we've actually been able to accommodate more people than we would have not with a full indoor church, but, you know, under the restrictions of 25% capacity, et cetera. The outdoor allowed more people to come.
Yeah, you know, and I was at St. John the Evangelist Parish in Carmichael mm-hmm. doing a visit to the school and going over the protocols, and Father Bernardin was saying mass outdoors, and it was so lovely. I just thought, you know, that you know, you always look for the silver lining, of course, but I just thought, you know, will people look back and say, hey, remember that year when we could do, you know, outdoor mass at dawn and how lovely that was?
Yeah.
So, and we're looking for the positive in ways to bring our families back into communion and community.
Lincoln, how many elementary schools are there in the Diocese of Sacramento?
So we've got 36 elementary schools.
36, and then how many high schools?
And we've got 6 high schools. So we have 37 elementary schools. I don't want to forget about our newest school, St. Clair, in South Lake Tahoe, mm-hmm. or North Lake Tahoe, rather. It's a little Montessori school up there. You know, the waivers are valid for grades 6 and under for right now.
Yeah, I was going to say, it is K through 6, right? It seems to be kind of the cutoff.
K through 6 is the cutoff, and that's just for the time being. Of course, that can evolve. The state's updated policies every month all throughout this. And so, of course, we're eagerly awaiting news about our middle schools. But for right now, they're accepting waiver applications through 6th grade, pending, of course, them fixing their data problem. So in our counties that are on the monitoring list, and we're hoping to get waivers to get kids back in through 6th grade, but in those counties for the older students, in particular our high schools, we're starting in distance mode, just pending the counties themselves coming off the watch list because they've brought down their infection rates.
How many counties do we have Catholic schools in, of the 20 in the diocese?
In 11 of them.
Mm-hmm.
In 11 of them. So it's, and every county has its own health officer who is the ultimate authority on whether or not we come back. So we're in relationship with a lot of different counties right now.
And as you say, the virtually everything is dependent upon the infection rate within that county. And, you know, now the state has admitted that they've had some dramatic problems with whether they're properly counting and reporting the infection rates in counties. And the other thing that's, I don't know, interesting and distressing about that is even within counties, there is great difference in the cities within a county in terms of infection rate.
Absolutely. It's part of the reason I feel that this waiver process is a prudent thing to do. I mean, certainly it's a reasonable thing to do. So Placer County, for example, is a very big county geographically. And
right.
We've got 3 schools in Placer, one in Roseville, one in Auburn, and one in Kings Beach, North Lake Tahoe. So, you know, we've advocated that, you know, the waivers are appropriate because, you know, North Lake Tahoe, for example, may have a very low infection rate,
mm-hmm.
But one of the other 2 cities might have a higher one. And so just because Roseville can't open, you know, North Lake Tahoe shouldn't necessarily have to stay closed too, or vice versa. And like I said, there seems to be an acknowledgement of that. So they are working with us little by little. But like I said, I know for our larger counties, the data problem is a concern, and it's just simply something we have to work through and be patient about as they figure out where we're actually at.
So it's not a hard and fast rule that it's just county by county. They would, if you could provide the data, or they provide the data. One part of the county where you have a school is could open, and the other part of the county where you have a school might not be able to open for in-person.
Exactly. It's been interesting talking to the counties, and without naming any particular counties, it seems that the data may be more messed up in some counties than others, because others seem prepared to talk to us and start moving toward reopening, whereas, you know, some counties are saying we just need more time to figure out where we're at.
Yeah, I know the a number of us who sort of, you know, we go to the county dashboards and look at usually in our own county first and see what the cities and the counties and what's happening. And it's varied, especially in the last couple of weeks, it's varied wildly, to put it mildly. To where you know that this is a reporting problem, not an actual, well, it's an infection problem, but the reporting's all over the map. One day it's very low, and the next day it's very high, and obviously that's reflection of reporting, not the suddenly in one day there was a huge spike.
Yes, exactly. Things do seem to come in waves. And sometimes there are spikes. You know, we in the counties where we seem to have seen the jump in infections, a lot of the feedback I've gotten and the ask from County Health, I've been asked to share this every time I'm out and about, and this includes right now, is that there seem to be spikes in infections in places like nursing homes and prisons and jails where people are in close quarters, and so you can see spikes there. But, multi-generational family gatherings do seem to be a hotspot in a number of our counties. And so, County Health has asked me to always share with your families that, you know, everybody has to do their part, and that includes within the family. So please be careful, because if we can cap this, it means we can get back to...
You know, you hear that over and over, and I've heard it enough that I believe it. And it's the family gathering is seductive that it's safe. You know, well, this is grandma. I know grandma doesn't have it. And this is grandpa. And here's Uncle Bill from, you know, he's from North Dakota. And they're visiting. Well, they're fine. And pretty soon you've got 20 or 30 people there for a graduation, a birthday, a retirement, whatever it is. And you're all in the backyard. And we all know each other. And we're hugging and sitting next to each other and telling stories and singing campfire songs. And pretty soon you've got 10 people who have it.
Yeah, and we understand how hard it is. I'm just coming from a large family myself, where we get those multi-generational get-togethers often. My poor grandmother is losing her mind because she loves nothing more than having the family together. But we've had to, let my poor grandmother know that we've got to wait a little bit, because we have to make sure we're keeping her safe more than anything.
Yeah, and because there's no question, the data is showing that it's a younger and younger group, not down into elementary school age, but, the 24 to 40, you're seeing real big spikes in that group. But still, 80% of those who are dying of this are over the age of 65.
Yes. The vast majority of people who seem to be particularly fragile, if they get it, are in that age range. So we're doing our part in my little family. We're having, I'm very blessed to have, three of my four grandparents still with us, so lots of longevity. But we're doing, socially distant gatherings on their decks outdoors, making sure that we're, I haven't hugged my grandmother since March, but I think that, which I know is hard for everybody, but trust me, I sympathize, but at the same time, seeing the data like I do every day, the way I do, it's just simply something we have to do for, most importantly, for her benefit.
We're with Lincoln Snyder, the superintendent of schools for all of the diocesan schools here in the Diocese of Sacramento, encompassing 20 counties, 11 of which have Catholic schools. Lincoln, give us just kind of a nuts and bolts of, okay, you have a school X in X county, and you're seeking a waiver. What are the particulars of that?
Well, if anybody wanted to see our documents, we actually have on the diocesan website, scd.org, under schools. They can click through and find our list. And so our schools have put together a 20-plus page document called our Return to School Plan, and we wrote one master plan for everybody. And then it's been tailored school by school to fit the needs of that school in that particular county. And so as we wrap up these plans, and we're on version 4 because they keep updating the requirements, we're submitting that plan to the counties, and one of the requirements is transparency. So anybody wants to see what our plan is and see what's happening for the school in their county, they can check it out on the website, scd.org, and under schools.
So from the county standpoint, what do you, in other words, say, before a county is going to grant you a waiver, what do you have to show them in terms of data?
They want to see, most importantly, what we're doing first and foremost, PPE, things like masks and social distancing within schools, our plans for hygiene, our plans for communication, what drop-off and pick-up look like. You know, there seems to be an acknowledgement that, you know, when kids are sitting in a desk, there's a lot of control when they're over the classroom, when they're in desks and rows and in one place. I know the counties are very worried about those bottlenecks in schools, things like pick-up and drop-off, and we don't have them, but school buses or cafeterias or lunches. And so we essentially tell the story of what our school day looks like from beginning to end and what we're doing for hygiene and training and family communication. And if somebody were to take ill, what's the process for letting people know or tracing the contacts? So, yeah, it's pretty thorough. Like I said, they published a document that had all the requirements for the waiver, and so we, to make it easy for them, you can go to the table of contents at the back of the report and click on the requirement, and it takes you to the page of the report where we address the concern.
And what you had in plan earlier in the summer, when you were hoping to or planning to go in person in the middle of August to start a school, would work. What pushed you out of it was the fact that counties' infection rates went up unexpectedly. It wasn't anything wrong with your plan.
Yeah, so that I think that the it was disruptive for us because, you know, in the case of many of our counties, we had already reviewed the plan, they accepted it, and then the government dropped new requirements on us in July, and then it turned out in August their data was bad. So, you know, I know that they are doing their best behind the scenes to move quickly. You know, some counties have been way more transparent about the challenges than others, but I know that, you know, that's I don't think a lack of goodwill on their part. They're just scrambling to keep up as best they can. You know, it's a tough time to be a county health officer. You know, three of our counties have turned public health officers just in the last couple of months.
Yep.
So we. You know, Yolo County just hired a new public health officer, and, you know, God bless him in stepping into this role this time. That's certainly public service at the above and beyond level.
And the state has just hired a new director of public health or whatever it is. You know, it's just their a very, very enormously high stress job right now, and even a lot of hostility being directed towards those people too.
Yeah, I think that there's it is politicized, and the church is already always studiously apolitical, or as Bishop Soto would say, that, you know, obviously, we try to make everybody uncomfortable at some point, just because the Catholic philosophy, I think, is follows its own logic and not the logic of electoral politics, but. Even things like health data have become politicized.
I mean,
people are very passionate about masks, for example. And, you know, we understand that this has been the topic of conversation for the country for 5 months now. And we'd expect nothing less. I mean, people have opinions, and that shows up in health directives.
So, within the school day. Would students be wearing masks all day?
Yes. So the protocol and the requirements from the state that came out do ask our students to be in masks. So our kids will be in masks.
Yeah.
Cotton mask, by the way, for your listeners, new data coming out, the good old-fashioned cotton mask is the most effective thing short of a surgical mask that a person could be wearing.
Yeah, there's a lot of data now, and you know, it's interesting because some masks are a lot more effective than other masks. And
yeah, absolutely. Like the bandana that my son was wearing, it turned out it doesn't work all that well, so he's not wearing a bandana anymore.
Yeah, and it's hard sometimes to get the proper guidance. Okay, I want to wear the best mask, and at least if we can afford it and they're available and all those things. Sometimes it's hard to get good data on that. And, of course, you go online and everybody's selling masks these days, and you have no idea, are these good masks? Are these average masks? So your data is, the good old-fashioned cotton mask.
Good old-fashioned cotton mask. Yep. Does the best of stopping particles compared to other things. And so fleece masks or bandanas actually don't really stop, good old fashioned. What's the technical term? I don't want to say spittle on air, but there
yes.
you go.
And
one emits, liquid when one is speaking, and
aerosol.
Aerosol. That.
There we
thank
go.
You.
That's the proper
yeah.
word.
Well, apologies to the readers for they're learning little by little. One thing that's really important to us and to public health is some countries have already gone back to school. And so we've got data based on what they're doing, and there's a lot of data. When you get down into the specifics, there's a lot of debates about what works and what doesn't. And, you know, what I share with parents is if you step back and look at the whole picture, the big picture of, like, well, Korea went back to school, and what does it look like for them? And there's some really great studies out of Korea showing what's worked. And it's not any one thing. It's more about does the entire plan work or not. And so I know public health has been paying very close attention to the data from the countries where the entire country's gone back to school and what's happened with infection rates and what were their policies. So they're like I said, it gets confusing when you get to the granular level, but when you look at the big picture and say, okay, they went back to school, what's happened to them? And you have to stay focused on the big picture, because it does get confusing for us lay people when we get down to that highly detailed level of, you know, this product versus that product.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, I mean, we were promised that from just about everybody, not just the politicians, but the epidemiologists were saying, oh, summer, it's probably going to fade away in the summer. It may come roaring back in the fall, but it's going to fade away in the summer to a very low degree, likely because of heat and et cetera. And I for some reason, it didn't happen, maybe because everybody's indoors in air conditioning. It didn't happen, and it's interesting. You look at professional sports. The NBA in their bubble seems to be able to survive. Major League Baseball having all kinds of problems. You know, where they're not in a bubble. They're traveling and they're doing those things, and that's not it's not really indicative for schools, but it does tell you that there are differences in activities that seem to be relatively the same. There's differences in the way you approach it.
Well, absolutely. You know, and again, I think the important thing for us and looking at our schools and looking at data from the other countries is that is the places where they've had the right protections in place and kids have gone back to school, the infection rates haven't gone up overall. In some cases, they've gone down. Mm-hmm. And you ask yourself, well, why is that? And so, well, because when kids are at school, we've got them in a highly structured, controlled environment with all of these safeguards in place, which is safer than them being in like, say, out and about in the community and unsupervised. And so like I said, it's not just about does this one thing work or not, but it's if you do this one thing or you don't do this one thing, what else will you be doing instead? And so it's complex. It's very, very complex. But like I said, we talked to, like, I have the luxury of talking to 11 different counties plus working with, one step removed from the governor's office at the state level as they're formulating policy. And so, you know, we look for those big trends where the clear picture emerges, over time rather than paying attention to the noise. Because, we understand. People are seeing news article after news article, this works, this doesn't work, do this, don't do that. Opinions change. But, again, we're really mining for those long-term trends.
Now, with the waiver, even though it would be granted by the county, the requirements of the waiver are dictated by the state. Is that correct?
They are. So the state set minimum requirements for the waiver. There's all sorts of things you're supposed to have in place, which we do in the protocol. and address those questions. If there is a spike in levels above a certain level, the state may not grant the waiver even if the county thinks it's okay. So it's a two-step process. The county collects the information from us, they review it, and then I haven't seen it, but I know that it exists because they told me they have a checklist from the state, and they have to match the waiver application against against the state checklist too. So it's up to the county health officer and his or her discretion, as well as they're making sure that, we're meeting the state expectations too.
And the timeliness of this, are we aware of, have any schools actually so far been granted waivers?
We have not received them yet. They just published the process last week and this week. So the county, they published the process last week at the state level, but then the county actually has to put the application on letterhead and send it to us. And we've gotten that for multiple counties now. So I think that we could have an announcement in the next 7 to 10 days about which counties have approved us to come back. So, you know, when we put out the announcement about this delay due to the waiver process, you know, we were hoping that September 8th would be a workable date for us if things look good and the county approves a waiver. And so we're hoping to hew to that timeline as closely as possible in as many counties as possible.
That's September 8th, another big day on the church calendar.
Always.
Always. Yeah, it's just, and we're moving up on Feast of the Assumption.
Always.
Which was opening day a couple of years ago, I believe.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We put that out. You know, wasn't that long ago that people seemed to start, go back to school after Labor Day, right?
And right.
You know, of course, we've got a few more requirements now with the curriculum, so we've had to push it up to middle of August. But when we said that we're shooting for starting then, for many it was kind of the intuitive date of generations past.
Yes, indeed. So if you started September 8th, which is the day after Labor Day this year, do you have to push your calendar further out in May or June?
We don't. You know, the state and the accreditation agencies have been very flexible this year just due to the challenges surrounding COVID. So we may end up with fewer instructional days, but we do plan on covering 100% of the academic content. So we're doing everything we can to finish on time. We may, in some places, need to push out a week, depending on if mm-hmm. we can push from September 8th. I mean, obviously, our parents want to make sure that we're delivering 100% of the content for the year, so their kids are on track, and we intend to do exactly that. But for this year, it's not a requirement of the state that we stick to that 180 days. That's our benchmark.
I look at the kids who just graduated from high school, and a lot of them are going to colleges where it's still uncertain if they're going to even be on campus.
Yeah, my alma mater, Georgetown, just sent out the letter saying that, you know, the School of Foreign Service, which is school diplomacy, essentially, is not going to have in-person interaction, and so they've got the same questions. How do you teach people to be a diplomat when you can't put them in the same room? So everybody's having to get creative here.
Yeah, it's interesting. What about enrollment? Has it affected your enrollment that you can determine?
That's a great question. Actually, I'm going to be sharing with Bishop and the boards today. It's uneven. You know, some schools are up, some schools are down. We're restating budgets. In some places, we've gone from not having a wait list to having a wait list of 40. And then in other schools, we've lost students. So, a lot of it very much seems to be particular to the community rather than any one particular thing. I would say that a number of our schools, we have significantly more schools are up than are down. I think with public schools offering a lot of uncertainty for families, especially in those areas where the public district maybe hasn't been as communicative, we've gotten a lot of phone calls from folks interested in Catholic school. You know, I think we demonstrated that we did a good job with distance learning. We were on it. Families recognize that, and so although public schools are starting in distance footing, just like we are, I think we've already demonstrated that we can do it really well. So, we've got a number of schools where, again, we're opening in distance learning, just like the neighboring public schools, but we've gained a significant enrollment.
Yeah, I think the word is out. People are marveling at how quickly you transitioned, didn't lose a single minute of instruction last spring or last March. I think the word's out.
Yeah, we, the last thing just for the readers on that, or the readers, your listeners rather, on that front too, is that, you know, we know that it's been difficult to take the sacraments, of course, in person throughout all of this. But, significantly more of our schools are up and down right now in enrollment, which is good. But all of our parishes depend on tithing and philanthropy to make their ends meet. And, you know, this has been very, very tough on parish finance. And
right.
People say, well, what can I do to support the school? It's like, well, figure out how to go back to the parish and tithe there if you can restart those. And, of course, we understand a lot of people have been hurt financially by this. And so, not putting undue pressure on people who are struggling, but, getting in the habit of going back to church and continue to donate to the parishes is really important. You know, our parishes have been hurt by the drop in attendance and the drop in tithing that followed.
Yeah, people should really be aware of that. You know, if you were... A lot of people, they contribute online or they contribute very regularly, even a payroll deduct kind of thing automatic deduct from your bank account. Others, though, and they've made pledges, but others, the basket comes and they drop a $10 bill in or whatever they've got, and they're not in mass, and that's not happening. If you're one of those people, and you haven't been, you're not laid off, and because we understand how hard that is for people, consider that's your church is there, and they need your financial support.
Yeah, indeed. Our parishes at the end of the day are community organizations, just like our schools. We only schools make their we're able to cover our bills through one of two sources, tuition or philanthropy, and our parishes depend 100% on philanthropy. So, we know that it's really important for us as church to make sure that we're doing all we can to reengage with our parishioners. Of course, understanding that everybody's going to be hurting coming out of this. It's going to be... the job market's going to be a tough one for a lot of people, and as church, we've always done everything we can to be there for families that are struggling, and that's still the policy.
Indeed. Lincoln, always a pleasure to talk with you. I'm sure there's about 18 phone calls that you're supposed to be answering right now, so back to work.
Back to work, indeed. Hey, Bob, always a pleasure. Anytime I can give the report, I'm always grateful to have a chance to reach out to your listeners.
Well, every day I go home and I tell my wife, I say, boy, they're so lucky to have Lincoln. They are. So appreciate all you do.
Hey, likewise. Thanks so much, and God bless. So God, look forward to talking to you soon.
God bless you, too. That's Lincoln Snyder, the superintendent of our great Catholic schools here in the Diocese of Sacramento. We'll take a quick break. Back with more on the Bishop's Hour right after this. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the Mercy Foundation, enriching lives in the Sacramento region through Sisters of Mercy ministries in healthcare, education, housing, and the care for the poor and elderly. For the Mercy Foundation, philanthropy is one of the most powerful expressions of compassion and love. Just as many people in our community need a hand, countless others are reaching out to them with comfort and hope. You can express your care and concern for the less fortunate with a gift to the Mercy Foundation. You can give them a call, 916-851-2700. That's 916-851-2700. And you can be confident that fully 100% of your contribution will support the Sisters of Mercy Ministry or ministries that you choose. And what a wonderful treasure Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts has been for all of us here in the diocese as they transition into new ownership and management. They continue to offer wonderful workshops, wonderful resources for the Catholic community throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Not only does Easter's provide a wide array of Catholic books, both current releases and longtime classics, but they also sponsor a number of valuable workshops and lectures throughout the year. They're located at 6916 Sunrise Boulevard in Citrus Heights. Give them a call, 916-338-7272. We also receive a generous underwriting support by Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. If you have questions about retirement, Crumley & Associates can help you with their confident retirement approach that can help define a clear roadmap to get you where you want to go. You can contact them, get all the details at Crumley & Associates, 7956 California Avenue in Fair Oaks. They're at 916-638-4600. That's 916-638-4600. And we are certainly appreciative of the fine and longstanding support of the Mercy Foundation, of Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts, and of Crumley and Associates.
Hi, this is Laura Lynn, Assistant Director for Lay Formation, and you are listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Dunning.
That's me. Welcome back, and appreciate you all being with us on the Bishop's Hour. And we're pleased to welcome in Tony Real, the Executive Director of the Catholic Foundation. Tony, good day to you.
Good day to you, and thank you for having me.
Are you just new, or are you brand new?
I would say I'm fairly brand new. I'm about 5 weeks into the position.
Still wet behind the ears?
A little bit, but getting more knowledgeable every day.
Tony, tell us just a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was born and raised here in Sacramento, went to Sacred Heart Grammar School and Jesuit High School, and then to the University of San Francisco. And my dad was a deacon in this parish at Sacred Heart for, gosh, over 30 years.
Wow.
So born and raised here, and very familiar with the diocese.
And where were you prior to coming here?
Prior to this, I was working in the office technology field for the last 27 years. And when I semi-retired, I wanted to do something a little more philanthropic, and started to talk about this position with the diocese here, and it all fell into place.
Oh, wonderful. So what did you study at USF?
Business administration.
You know, I had the pleasure of, before they canceled the college basketball season in December, I was at USF to cover a basketball game as a sports writer. And looking at all those national championship banners, and by golly, a guy walks by about 8 feet tall. It was Bill Cartwright.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, from Elk Grove.
Well, he's one of the legends.
Yeah, he's one of the legends. And he came over to the press table and was just as I got a picture with him. You know, it was just he was just as friendly and accommodating as could be. You know, you wouldn't have known he was such a big deal. Other he's a big guy, obviously. But
yeah, no, he's a very nice man. I've met him a couple times.
Yeah, and I think he's on the staff there, not coaching, but maybe in the athletic department, something like that.
He is. Yeah, most definitely.
So what a beautiful campus that is.
It's really nice. The church there is just beautiful. It really is an incredible place to go to Mass.
Yeah, indeed. So your duties here at the Catholic Foundation, tell us a little bit about what is the Catholic Foundation?
So the Catholic Foundation, we're here really to provide assistance for the parishes and the schools throughout the diocese, and really to help them, you know, not only survive but thrive. And we're really financial stewards for all of the different parishes throughout the Sacramento Diocese.
So you're hired during a time where everything's virtual. I mean, we would have you sitting right across the table here talking
right.
to you. Somebody would be taking you around the building saying, oh, you got to meet Gladys, you got to meet Bill, and doing all this. And you'd be going out to lunch with people and eating donuts and having coffee and having meetings and all that. How is it being into a completely new environment, new job, and yet we're doing all this virtual stuff?
Well, it certainly presents its challenges, that's for sure. And I would much rather be meeting face-to-face with pastors and parish members and you. But we're faced with this pandemic, and I think it's more incumbent upon us than ever to really figure out how to communicate effectively during this time, and that translates to the parishes, because they're really struggling, some of them with the best ways to communicate with parishioners when you can't hold Mass, and trying to stay in contact, trying to promote different service activities that still need to get done, but it's much harder when it's very limited to the number of people that can be in one place at one time.
Yeah, and I think it's easy for people who, and we were talking about this with Lincoln Snyder, superintendent of Catholic schools, that you're used to going to Mass, and I know a lot of people, have a regular, they have envelopes and they put money in it or they have it deducted from their bank accounts, but there are a lot of people that they're just putting money in the basket when it comes by.
Right.
And when the basket doesn't come by, they're not putting money in, and it's not all about money, but somebody's got to pay the light bill.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the parishes, depend on that. And we actually just held a virtual conference, kind of along the lines of what you were just asking me, 2 weeks ago on, I think, July 23rd. And we had over 135 pastors and finance council members attend, and it was all on e-giving. And mm-hmm. e-giving is, where the parishioners can sign up and donate money on a regular basis.
Right.
It just automatically happens. And one of the discussions was, the parishes that have really embraced that type of technology have done okay during this pandemic, because it's just a natural part of the parishioner's thing. It's just happening. The donations are coming in. And the parishes that haven't embraced it yet, are certainly having their more struggles because of that. So, we had a great session, and we had a few vendors come on to discuss the different ways that they can set up e-giving at the parish sites and on their websites. And so it was very informative. I've got a lot of positive feedback, and that was kind of my first experience in working with a lot of the parishes, and it was virtual, but it was very helpful.
Yeah, I know a few years ago, back when we had the One campaign, and my wife and I discussed, how can we contribute and what can we contribute, et cetera. And the thing that made sense was, let's put it over a couple of years and let's make it automatic deduct so we don't even see it, so that every month we're not sitting down to write a check and think about it and, just do it.
Exactly.
Not to make it painless, but to make it for sure that we were going to do this.
And, absolutely. Yeah.
And it just made a lot of sense. And if everybody did that, it would be very helpful, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And it's been a blessing for the parishes that have really, you know, gone ahead of time and had the parishioner signed up and the program is already in motion. And so I think a lot of parishes realized during this time that they really need to get with the program and you know, embrace modern technology to do that. And it is extremely helpful. And it's easier for the parishioners, to be honest.
We're talking with Tony Real, the new executive director of the Catholic Foundation here for the Diocese of Sacramento for all 20 counties. Every time the diocese hires somebody new and we interview them on the radio, I say, do you have good tires on your car? Because this is a big diocese.
It is a very big diocese, yeah. 42,000 square miles, I believe.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's just one of the biggest dioceses in the country.
It is, yeah.
You know, there's a few. Wyoming is all its own, and Utah is all its own, so those are a little bit bigger, but we're pretty darn big. And, you know, a million Catholics spread out some of the counties, you know, very light population, and some of the counties, like Sacramento County, very, very heavy in population. What do you see starting out as you know, what's your biggest hurdle right now? What do you need to get done in the early stages here?
Well, my main emphasis is on the parishes and the schools and doing whatever we can to help them through this you know, difficult time. You know, we're not sure when this pandemic's going to end, and you know, it'd be nice if it was over soon, but, you know, we just can't predict that. So we've got to do our best to help them, you know, whether it's online communications, doing their best to get the word out on social media, on their websites, maybe redesigning some websites and advertising, not, you know, in a way of speaking, advertising to the parishioners to let them know what's going on and keep them informed. So that's really important. And we're also focusing on stewardship as a program that we really feel is the future for the parishes and to help them, you know, again, grow and thrive.
Now, there's a stewardship conference coming up.
There is, on September 10th,
mm-hmm.
and that's going to be a virtual conference also, and it is put on by the Stewardship Conference of the United States, and it's Eric McCardle is the founding member of that group, and they do just a wonderful job in teaching the stewardship conference concepts, and so it'll be a great conference, and so we're really hoping that we get a lot of attendance from the different parishes, and we're working on getting the word out right now, so thank you for bringing that up.
So how do people sign up for this, and who specifically are you looking for to attend this?
So ideally, we would, you know, love the pastors of the parishes to be in attendance. Members from the Finance Council would be great. Members from the Pastoral Council would also be helpful. You know, it's definitely a team effort to get the program and concept of stewardship running to its fullest in the parish, and you need many different members to be on the same page and working towards the same goal.
And this conference will be September the 10th?
September the 10th. And they have a lineup of speakers that have, you know, gone around the country and spoken at conferences, you know, when they were live. But this will be virtual. But they are well-versed in the concepts and the strategies that have been successful in other parishes and to really help set the kind of a foundation for what needs to be done.
So is this conference just within the Diocese of Sacramento, even though these are national speakers, or is this a national conference going on throughout the country?
This is just for the Sacramento Diocese, mm-hmm. and I, you know, the Catholic Stewardship Consultants are the people putting it on. I gave you the wrong name a little earlier. Sorry about that.
Yeah, and Eric McCardle is the president of that group, and also Sherry Navarette will be speaking. She's from the Catholic Stewardship Consultants as well.
Exactly. And they're all well-versed and do just a wonderful job in assisting parishes and getting the stewardship concept running.
Is this something that's under the auspices of the USCCB or Catholic Stewardship Consultants? Are they separate from that?
I think they're all part of the same. You know, Catholic Stewardship Consultants is a separate company, and their main focus is on, you know, they send in teams to work with parishes. Mm-hmm. If the parish decides to go with the program, so the Catholic Stewardship Consultants will send members in to work with them, you know, over a period of time to make sure that that program's up and running. They have the right materials, the right communications going. So they're part of the overall umbrella, but they're their own entity.
Very good. Very good. And if you go to scd.org, which is the diocesan website here, Sacramento Catholic Diocese, you can see all about the conference, and you can also read how to sign up.
Yeah, if you go to the Catholic Foundation section of right. The website, there's a link there to register.
Very good. Tony, have you learned the secret handshake yet or anything like that?
No, no one has shown me because there's no one here to show me that. It's a fairly empty building at this point.
I think it's the secret elbow bump now.
That must be it, yes.
Well, awfully good to talk with you. Please don't be a stranger to this program. If we can help the foundation in any way, that's why we're here. And just welcome aboard, and great to talk with you, and best wishes and prayers for great success.
Well, I appreciate that very much. Thank you for having me on, and look forward to speaking with you again when we have some other programs running.
Very good. God bless, Tony. Thanks so
Thank
much.
You,
yeah, that's Tony Real, who is the executive director of the Catholic Foundation and the Stewardship Conference. Again, September 10th, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., go to the diocesan website, scd.org, to sign up. We'd like to thank all the wonderful people and organizations, businesses in town and throughout the Diocese of Sacramento who have provided underwriting for the Bishop's Hour, some in the last few years, some have been with us for a very long time. If you would like to be an underwriter for the Bishop's Radio Hour, it's a wonderful opportunity to support this mission and also to support the diocese and also to get some recognition for your organization or for your business. So the easiest way to do this is to give us a shout, send us an email, radio@scd.org, and we can give you all the details about helping to underwrite the Bishop's Radio Hour. Again, that's radio@scd.org.
Oh, and from the fear of death. fear.